This is Conversations About Foster Care.
In this first season, join our conversation about transitions, removal, and coping with change, trauma, and grief.
The system is made up of all of us, so let's talk about how we can do better by our kids.
Hi everyone, it's Kurt.
And Marika.
Welcome back to the podcast. It's episode 5, and there goes Maverick.
You can hear his paws on the... Oh, he's Maverick. A little shake.
So we're talking today about the trauma of transition. This particular interview is with two guys, John and Brian, who Ricky knows through work. They had a foster child in their care for a period of time, and then that foster child went back to live with the Burr family, and a couple of years later came back to their foster care and then was eventually adopted. And this is a really good example of the trauma that they had to deal with in kind of unpicking that trauma for the child as the child grew up and is still growing up. So this is a really good example, I think, of a child showing trauma and how they've had to deal with it.
Yeah. So a little bit of backstory of how I know John and Brian. John works in the theatre industry like I do. He makes incredible costumes, and currently actually I wear his costumes every night. I was going in for a costume fitting at the very beginning of the project I'm now working on, and I had our foster daughter with us, and she had a poopy diaper and we desperately needed to change her.
So 42nd Street. And
yeah, we're right in the middle of Midtown in Manhattan, and I was about to, you know, go into this costume fitting at this fancy place, and I wanted to make a really good impression. And of course, the elevator doors opened and I'm standing there with a smelly diaper baby. And but they were, of course, really beautiful and brilliant about it, and brought us into a very, very fancy dressing room for her to have a change. And we ended up talking, and it turns out we were all foster parents. So that's how we met and bonded. I'm sure as you, if you're a foster parent out there, you know that when you meet anyone else, you immediately...
Welcome them with open arms. Yeah, brother.
Incredible intimacy straight away, because you're all in the trenches of it together. And sometimes the only person who can really understand some of the duality and mix of emotions that go into this territory is other foster parents. So that's a little bit of backstory as to how I met John and Brian, and I'm so grateful to them for letting us have this interview. The other thing to remember is we tried to do this on the phone with three people, and we've never done that before. So we're going into real new territory here with the podcast. So I beg your patience. We don't talk over each other a lot, but there are a couple of instances. So that's why. And here's the interview with John and Brian.
Good morning. It's lovely to talk to you both on the phone and sort of re-meet you again.
Yes, you too.
I think we'll, the only thing we'll have to be careful of is that we don't talk on top of each other with this three-way situation.
I won't speak.
Well, I know we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to just dive straight in and ask, I guess, one of you to tell the basic story of receiving the placement of your daughter and her leaving and then returning into your family.
So we became foster parents in April of 2011. In November, we got our first placement, and then that's our first daughter. So she's been with us since then. And then we opened our home again. We had her for about a year, and we said, you know, we would welcome another child. In February of 2013, they called. There was a little girl at the hospital that needed to be picked up. So that was in February of 2013, brought home a five-day-old. That was our second daughter. We got the call from the caseworker, said this might be crazy and, you know, it might not be the right time, but we have another infant. Would you consider having another infant in your home? She's going to be foster adopted, which was, we positioned ourselves as a foster adopted family. We knew that if we brought a child into our home, we couldn't emotionally handle giving that child up. And mm-hmm. In New Jersey, the laws are such that you can pretty much tell your resource worker, you know, it's sort of a strange menu. You know, you go through what type of child, what gender, what age, what type of family you would be. And the options were a foster family, which is, you know, your typical, stereotypical, they come, they go. The whole goal there is for reunification. There's yes. Emergency placement, which is typically it's a weekend situation where they just need to put a child until they can figure out the case. And we did that the first time. That was actually our first placement and what was supposed to be our last placement, because we decided after that we didn't want to be parents. Ha, ha, ha. 4 children later. The foster adopt was these children had either been through the system so long that they were on the adoption track, or the family history was such that they knew that the child would eventually be in an adoption situation, so they wanted to place the child in a foster adopt home so they wouldn't have to transition to another home.
Yes.
Then, of course, there's respite care, which is helping other foster parents when they need a weekend off. But we were just a foster adopt family. So when she called, she said Alima, who's number three, was a foster adopt family based on mom's history. Mom had had, I think Alima's her sixth child, none of whom she was able to raise. And so she's coming out of the hospital. She's 12 days old. Would we consider another infant? I called John. He was like, oh, okay. Sounds okay. So they dropped her off. I think it was on a Friday. Then they drive away and they're like, here, have an infant. And yeah. My sister had her twins 16 years ago and I was there. And, you know, so the two infant thing wasn't strange to me, or it was, I understood sort of what the dynamic was going to be. What I don't think we were prepared for was having a child who was going through withdrawals from drugs. And I've always described to the first 10 weeks with her, she was just plain angry. She was just mad. Wow. Because her body was going through what her body needed to go through to get healthy.
Yeah.
So 10 days later, they came back to us and said there was a mix-up. Alima was actually going to be a foster child. The bio dad was in the picture. And so they had to go through the process, the whole process with her, and not just put her on the foster adopt track based on the mom's history. So they asked us if we wanted to give her back. They said, would you like us to place her somewhere else in a proper foster home? Because they knew our boundaries. And 10 days in, you know, we had already learned a lot about her. We sort of knew her rhythms. We knew, you know, what the situation was, and we made a commitment to her. And as John always says, the way we were trained is when you get a child, you keep that child as long as you can just to give them some sense of continuity and security the best that you can. But you just have to sort of put your hands up because none of it is in your control.
Yeah.
It's in the control of all these other adults that are outside of your home, not dealing with the child directly, who are going to make decisions about that child in their life.
Yeah.
So we said, okay, we're going to commit to it. It was the judge in that case, we never actually met the judge. We're told we weren't supposed to. But the judge made a lot of decisions that we didn't really necessarily agree with. And so in October of that year, the caseworker came to us and said, well, they're now really pushing for reunification.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, we knew that the parents were homeless at the time. We knew a little bits and pieces about their history at that point. And she was doing her weekly visits. And I said to the caseworker, I said, well, then I would like to meet the parents. We would like to meet the parents.
Of course.
Well, she said, why?
And wow.
And as we've learned with foster care, the caseworkers in particular are in a very sort of unique and often tragic situation where they're dealing with a birth family that isn't able or capable to care for a child. And oftentimes, the foster parents actually aren't as interested in the well-being of the children necessarily. They're interested in, you know, caring for them and making sure that they have a roof over their head, but some of them don't necessarily think long-term. They don't get necessarily as attached as we do. We know that some of them are in it for a financial gain, so there is really no financial gain that we found all of it. So they're in this really peculiar position where they're not necessarily seeing the best of humanity. And so her question of why, it didn't surprise me, but what I said to her was, well, we consider these children our children. If someone was to come to you and say, I'm not going to take your child and go give it to this other person, wouldn't you want to meet that person? And her response was, yes, of course. She did bring up that she was a little concerned that the father in particular might have a problem with us being both white and being a gay couple. She said, I don't have a real gauge on that yet, but it is a concern. So I'm going to have to talk to my supervisor, which is always code for, let me get back to you. I don't want to make, you know, I don't want to say the wrong thing right now. And so we sort of left it. I did ask, actually, I said, can we start at least writing notes to them.
Yeah.
Which I started to do every week. I put her in the car, you know, as they transport her back and forth to her visits. I would just write a note, wouldn't sign it, wouldn't say anything, saying, you know, Alima, this week she started eating solids or she started to crawl or whatever, just to give her, give them a sense of what was going on, but also to try to humanize the situation that we weren't just, you know, babysitting her, but we were actually caring for her. So it was Christmas Eve of that year in 2013 that the caseworker called and said, I know it's Christmas Eve, can I come over? Sure, not a problem.
Uh-oh.
And she said that the mom has pushed to meet us. The mom wanted to meet us. And so she said that at that point she felt okay and compelled enough to sort of introduce us a little bit to them and describe us because she'd kept all the information confidential up to that point. We finally sat down and met with them for the first time, mm-hmm. Which was, I don't know how to describe that. Honestly, what it was the first thing that they said was, thank you so much for caring for our child. And it was just very sweet. And they said, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but would you consider being her godparents? And we're like, yes, of course.
I think
whatever to happen to you, to them, we would, of course, take her.
And I think they were just so incredibly optimistic. It was really touching to be with them on that day. You could see all of the struggle that they've been going through in their lives.
Wow.
And well-intentioned people who really put a lot of faith in what Alima could give to them in the future, which is not great.
They kept talking about how she was their angel and she was the one that, you know, had come to them to turn their lives around. And, you know, the systems that are in place for African Americans to sort of rise out of whatever situations they find themselves in life, there's so many obstacles that they face. And then to sort of think that this child is suddenly going to create this insta family, this nuclear family that especially the bio dad, you know, had hoped so much for. It just was really, touching. But we sort of sat there and then afterwards and talking with the caseworker, just sort of like, I don't think the reality of trying to like have stability in your life and get an apartment, get a job, pay rent, pay electricity, like all of that was just not something
for an excellent.
Yeah, I mean, he had a history of being incarcerated, and she had a drug problem. Like, it was just, like, a lot for them to... They really needed to take care of themselves before they could take care of a child. Simultaneously, it was actually around that Christmas break as well that... I think it was in November of that year, John, of 13, that John called from work. I was home with the kids and said, I'm under my table. I'm having a nervous breakdown and I need to talk to someone because the idea of letting her go is not something that I'm dealing well with.
Right.
And that's the part that is so strange and unique to the foster care system is the impact, the emotional impact that it'll have on the foster parents when they are so invested in the child.
It was the situation of being at work with people coming and going that were having these happy, healthy lives. Other designers that I was meeting with who were getting ready to have a baby, like just all this stuff. And I was getting ready to say goodbye to mine. I couldn't process. Having trouble again right now.
We reached out to our resource worker and we asked her, cause she had always said, you know, there's counseling available. So it was in December, I remember sitting down for the first time with the counselor who was able to come to our home, and it was provided by the state. And it was basically, it was bereavement counseling so that we could start to, and this company actually, it was licensed through the state, but they specifically worked with foster care families. So they worked with kids in foster care, foster parents, the reunification process. So the counselor really spoke the language versus someone who was sort of outside of the system that you sort of have to catch them up on all the terminology and,
Which is what we did. Because New York does not have such resources.
So the counseling started at the same time. Our relationship with the parents, with the birth parents, really sort of grew in a very strange way. I started to, you know, go over there to visit. She obviously was going over there. We started taking on, you know, driving her over. Also, I remember taking them like to the grocery store that was around the corner in order to show them the foods that she liked as we were inching towards this sort of final date. So we were hearing grumblings along the way that mom especially wasn't feeling prepared, but dad kept, you know, pushing for it. And the judge was sort of like, okay, you've met this benchmark. You've met this benchmark. Go ahead and do reunification. So we eventually moved towards the reunification date. It was July 24th, 2014.
How long has she been in your family?
14 months and a day. For me, personally, was the worst day of my adult life. Putting her in the back of a car with her stuff that we had packed up and telling her to be brave and watching that car drive away. The caseworker was crying. She was crying. I was crying. Yeah. We all instinctually knew that it wasn't the best, but it's what the judge said, and it's what he thought was right, even though we knew it wasn't. So she was at 14 months. She was, she and Vanessa, you know, they're 3.5 months apart. Developmentally was doing great. She was ahead of Vanessa. She was walking first, talking first. Was just a great kid with a lot of potential. You know, we had direct contact with the family, so, you know, I got a couple calls. She wasn't eating the first couple of weeks. She's probably upset.
And did the agency and the social workers in that case assist to make that transition for her clear and positive and smooth? What sort of things were in place to help with that? Or if they didn't, how did you guys manage that transition? What sort of things did you try to do in the lead up to help her understand what was happening?
Telling a 14-month-old, like having her cognitively understand that, there wasn't much we could do other than connect them, like try as best we could to, like that was one of the big things with the food, was trying to make sure that she had things that she knew and was comfortable with, like so it wasn't suddenly going into a strange environment with, that she had been on these visits with them, which was, I forget, John, I don't know if you remember if she did an overnight.
Yeah, leading up to
I think she did like a couple of overnight.
How did they go?
Fine. Yeah, you know, it's all fantasy. She's there for 24 hours and it's like, oh, this, you know, this is possible.
Yeah, and it's, totally.
And he was working, like he had to be at work at 10 or 11 in the morning and then work until 10 at night.
I think actually, John, that's when he was working in the graveyard. He was still, he hadn't got the other job yet.
Right. But he was gone a lot and then trying to sleep in the day. And so it was mom who wasn't really on board with the process and Alima alone most of the time.
And she just physically couldn't, just due to her, the mental state that she was in, and also just the attempts at recovery weren't exactly successful. I think that the system did put in place a family helper for a while.
I can't remember if that was right at the beginning or is it that was something we asked for that again later. We stayed involved and would continue to talk to the caseworker and request help for them. And then the next caseworker that came in too, we were able to communicate with to try to tell them that the woman needed assistance. We needed to be very aware that this wasn't working terrifically at all. And they were okay with it, but we have no idea how, what actually happened at that point. We were always told, yes, we'll get somebody in to check on
and the house. You guys did get to visit with her a little bit, or was there some sort of some sort of contact?
Well, what we did was we asked for some time. We needed to readjust. We needed her siblings to adjust of her not being there. And so we did ask for a couple of months, and it was, I think, about 3 months. And then we started doing monthly visits, where she would come to our home for a weekend. We actually had moved in between. We had left that old house that we were in and moved to a bigger house. And I remember, the first time she came to this house, and she still has a very kinetic energy and just ran through it. Like, because she was living in a one bedroom apartment. And
we had been in a two-bedroom house in Maplewood before, and moved into a 6-bedroom in West Orange afterwards.
Yeah, so a little different.
It's only 5. You make it sound palatial.
12-bedroom.
Yeah. But also, we started to hear that mom was afraid to take her out because mom was not able to handle the impulsiveness of a toddler. So she was pent up in this little apartment. And I remember actually we would go and pick her up and stuff, and suddenly you'll see the graffiti on the walls. Like, there was crayon everywhere. She just, mm-hmm. you know, she was in a situation that was not ideal. And
piles of toys.
Dad
would bring home any toy, and he was always putting things on layaway and doing things to provide for his baby.
Mm.
And we continued that for quite some time. So she left in 2014. It was April of 2016 that we got a call from another caseworker. Actually, it was dad. It was bio dad called. Mom had relapsed. He was heading to the emergency room. Could we come and pick up Alima?
So this is nearly 2 years later. Is that right?
Uh-huh. It's almost 2 years later. The challenge that we found is that we were watching her sort of regress. She wasn't hitting developmental benchmarks. Her language was delayed, and she was an extremely physical child, both in just, like, she would come to our house and just sort of rip it apart because of the stimulus of just being in the space. But also, you know, if she didn't get her way, it was hitting, kicking. It was just, the communication was just very physical.
Brian and I had started talking about this wasn't something that we could continue for our family because the disruption on our two daughters was just too much. It was too violent.
I was going to ask you about that in particular. Like, how did, you know, reunifying her at that time affect your other kids and just your family? How was that grief? How did you manage that for the other kids and for yourselves in your marriage?
The grief for the kids wasn't as acute. Our oldest was she 6 at the time?
4.5.
It didn't impact her directly. She's also sort of a happy-go-lucky kind of kid. And then the younger one, I'm sure...
kind of blossomed, actually.
Yeah, she started to sort of come into her own. But certainly having her back, it was just a jolt to all of us, you know. And we all loved her. She always had a bed here. They all slept in the same room at the time. Everyone knew where everyone's place was when she came, but it was definitely difficult. I would also say that when she did reunify, we started the counseling at the beginning of the year. They continued the counseling services. We finally concluded everything in December of that year because we sort of had moved through the grief, and the grief was definitely, for us as adults, was 100% real in the strangest way. And I remember saying to John is, it's like you have a death of a child, but the child is still out there. So you're grieving the loss, but not in the same way that a parent who loses a child grieves. It's just sort of an unknown, unless you're a foster parent who has given up a child.
Understand. Yeah.
There's no way that anyone can really understand what it means.
Yeah.
So in April of 16, the case had gone to another county. They called, and basically,
mom had left her in the hallway.
Mom had left her strapped in her stroller in the hallway
and passed out.
The police had called. They found her inside, passed out.
Brian was off doing something with our daughters. I went to the emergency room to help with Alima and to bring her home. And immediately when I got to the hospital, she fell asleep on my chest. And then again, I had people all around saying, well, you can see where she's actually comfortable. So.
And how old was she then? How old was she when all this went down?
She would have been just about 3.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, just about 3. And so...
So her cognition of the situation by then would have been pretty established in that she knew she lived with mom and dad, but she visited with you reasonably regularly.
Right,
and
right.
So she was in these two worlds. Yeah, wow.
And navigating both. She was perfectly fine to be in either place. When I would bring her home to her parents' house, she would just take the place by storm. Mom would tell me that she's been very feisty. They've been fighting a lot, physical altercations, mostly from Malima and that she was struggling. We would talk about parenting. Was quite friendly with the birth mom, and she was doing the best she could. She was absolutely doing the best she could.
Yeah.
So the case, it started to get really sort of challenging all around. It was October of that year. We were told that birth mom had cancer. So the plot thickened at that point. She was supposed to get treatment. We didn't really have a sense of a prognosis, but she essentially ended up bedridden for quite some time.
And so this whole time your daughter's being parented by her birth father predominantly, is that where she is?
That's what we were being, well, she was being dropped off at daycare Monday through Friday. Yeah. And then we sort of tried to help where we could, but we were also under the strain of all of it. And with her continuing to regress and just not developmentally moving forward, we had to come to terms with the fact that we had to make a choice that was in the best interest of all of us involved. We did also notice that I'm a child of divorce, and I was telling John, the worst day after you spend a weekend with your other parent is going back to the other family. It's just really difficult. And so for us to continually put Alima through this separation from us and us having to, you know, put the pieces back together after she left, it just was getting to be too much. And it might just be in everyone's best interest for us to, you know, pull away to a certain degree and let them try to navigate their lives and navigate her life as best they possibly could. So we also decided to reopen our home and negotiating a placement, a foster adopt placement of an 18-month-old girl who had been in a foster care situation, but that mother was not interested in adoption. She was then placed in a foster adopt home and she was being neglected. And so they were looking for a more stable environment for her, would we consider. We met her, I think it was January 6th of 2017. Met her, brought her over. She met her sisters. She was a little timid. That makes me laugh, John. She was a little timid that day. 10 days later.
Instructed to take over.
What's that?
She was obviously instructed to take over the place.
Yeah.
I'm guessing she's not timid now.
She's 4 years old now, and she thinks she runs the place. So that was January 19th. On January 29th, 10 days later, I got a frantic phone call from Alima's bio dad that her mom had passed. Could we come and pick her up? You know how they say that there's sort of a stereotype of what happens when children are plucked out of their home? In the middle of the night or in the late in the evening.
Yeah.
She came home to us in, this is January, mind you, a dirty t-shirt, a dirty pair of shorts, and shoes, no socks, and her jacket. I picked her up. I scooped her up. I took him over to the hospital. His mom had been swept away after she had collapsed in Alima's presence. Alima went running out again of the apartment. A neighbor found her. So she came home and, again, knew exactly where her bed was. We gave her a shower. We fed her, put her to bed.
Vanessa came out and saw that Alima was there, and Gia had just come 10 days before. And I remember Vanessa lighting up at the end of the living room and said, "So many sisters."
That next week was a little crazy with the syscom. Mom had passed. Dad was definitely in sort of all sorts of personal turmoil. And he wanted her placed officially in foster care in our home. Basically,
did he just feel like he couldn't support her and meet her best needs on his own?
What he needed to do at that point was he knew that he needed to sort of restructure his entire life. He was living in a subsidized housing under her name.
Right.
He technically should not have been living there because, again, the system's in place to help people rise out of any sort of situation. So he was afraid. He told me, "I'm just going to come home and the place is going to be padlocked once they find out that she's gone. And I can't be standing outside of the door with a 3-year-old in my hand looking at a padlocked door." he also knew that he had to find housing. He had to figure out his job situation. Like all of these things, his whole world sort of just crumbled in front of him.
Got it.
As he was trying to figure out his life, because at that point we still didn't know if we were going to adopt her, but at least she was placed in our home officially as a foster child.
But observing, you know, your 3.5-year-old and of course your other kids, and how was that transition back into your family? How did you guys all adjust, and how did you help her to understand and process yet another enormous change in already her tiny, small, short life?
Right.
You know, like it's crazy.
She was still working on it. Yeah. She was 3.5 at the time. She was not potty trained at 3.5. Her verbal was completely off. Like she couldn't actually, diction was, she spoke another language almost. Really hard to understand. She was angry before. She was 10 times as angry because it was so constant. I always likened her to a feral cat. Like she just, there was just so much going on with her. And it took, well, we immediately got her assessed with a local preschool, which had a special ed program. She qualified for special ed. So we got her into there. We kept the counseling going. The biggest challenge was integrating with the other girls was really difficult because she had been an only child, because she was the center of everyone's world. And if she didn't get her way, she would throw her fit, she would hit them, and then mom would give in. So we were dealing with this sort of crazy energy, and it was so difficult and so challenging because we knew it could have all been avoided. We knew that she didn't have to be this. I remember calling her bio dad and saying, when she got angry, did she hit you guys? And he just sort of chuckled. It was sort of like, oh, yeah. Like it was sort of a norm for them. Well, it was not
kind
a norm.
Kind of proud of her spunk.
Yeah. Like it was an okay thing. It was really hard on Vanessa, honestly. Vanessa quickly learned how to defend herself. Alima still has a scar on her nose that Vanessa gave her from scratching her face just to get her away from her. It was very disruptive. And I was just telling the school counselor yesterday, the year of the four-year-old was really, really challenging just because developmentally she was behind. And then she sort of pulled Vanessa into this vortex of just these crazy emotions. And we're still dealing with it. They're both 6 now. They're both in first grade. But even last night, Alima had just a rage. I mean, she just goes into these rages, and trying to help her navigate that, trying to make sure she doesn't hurt us, hurt herself, hurt her sisters. Like, there's still issues there. We also realized that she wasn't hard of hearing, which was impacting her speech. She had an overabundance of earwax, which was blocking her hearing, which was delaying her speech. So we now have regular flushings of her ears so that she can hear. The first time it happened, she was like, it's so loud. her whole world was muffled. You know, we got her the glasses because she needs the glasses. It's all these things that, you know, I'm not sure that her bio parents were set up to help her succeed in all of these things that she needed. But now she's gotten all those things. She is excelling at school. We just had parent-teacher conferences yesterday. School is her safe haven. It's the home where, if you've read anything on trauma-informed care or anything dealing with a child who's filled with trauma, when they're in these home environments that are unstable, they're on constant alert.
Yeah.
So their fight, flight, or faint mechanism is hypersensitive. And so any slight from anything, like I think last night it was her sister was only reading to the younger sister. She wasn't reading to her during story time. This blossomed into, you know, the biggest meltdown of the week thus far over the slightest thing. If I show too much affection towards one of the other kids, she has to jump on me and say, my baba. She regresses into sort of this baby talk thing that we're still working on. Ultimately, what I think we have realized is her trauma really didn't start necessarily when she went to live with these people. Her trauma started the day that she was put in the back of that car, because the only family that she had known up to those 14 months, in her little mind, suddenly abandoned her.
Yes.
It suddenly was gone, you know,
yeah.
And by no fault of our own, by no fault of hers, but because of the system that thinks that that's the best for the child, regardless of the true circumstances.
Yeah, and you've just articulated exactly why we're making this podcast, because, you know, we're just seeing time and time again that the context of these cases and the transitions of these kids out of homes that they've never known anything different is being handled with such insensitivity and such flippancy, and kids are being traumatized.
Right. 100%. Our child is a result of childhood trauma. We see it on a daily basis. And it is something that she will have to work on probably for the rest of her life to feel secure, to feel not threatened. She just feels so threatened all the time. I mean, even yesterday, actually, when we got home, one of her sisters ran up the stairs from our garage to the kitchen to say hello to Daddy first. Mm-hmm. And it broke her heart. It's just like, it's okay, Daddy will still love you if you get up there after her. She's just like, but I wanted to be first.
I'm so, you know, humbled and grateful to you guys for opening up and sharing what your family has been through. And I'm really pleased to listen. And I hope that it helps other people to relate and hook into your story. Because as you say, if you're not a foster parent, it's really hard. When we were going through when our daughter was removed, we went to try and find other people and other resources and other podcasts and other movies or books or anything that tells you how to deal with this particular type of grief and how to make this better for the kid, most importantly. And there really was very little out there to help us navigate that for her. And that's really shameful, because as we all know, the people who suffer are the kids.
Right. I forgot to tell the happy part, the happy ending of the story.
Oh.
What's that?
Go on.
In November of 2017, on the same day, both Alima and our fourth daughter, Gia, were adopted officially. We actually have open adoption with Alima and her dad. He's doing the best that he can. He has visited a couple of times. Gia, we actually proposed through the system to have an open adoption, which made those birth parents decide to do an identified surrender of her to us, having never officially meeting us. They did that, but we were open to it and have never been contacted by them. But I think it gave them a sense of agency and a sense of that they felt that they were participating in the placement versus just being told by the system, this child's going here and that's the end of the story. We've connected with a bio brother who was also just recently adopted. So she has that connection as well. So as happy as can be expected to the long journey of Alima's adoption story.
Mm. And how do you guys take care of each other during all of something like this? It's such a crazy story.
John, how do you take care of me? Please, let me count the ways.
Through our therapy, it was recommended that we do our nightly check-ins, which when we're in distress, we try to do again. That's about it.
Yeah, we definitely currently
we're kind of consumed by our lives.
We're seeking to be more in the thriving versus surviving mode with our kids.
Yeah.
Just in terms of them being in school and their schedules. And we really, getting them up in the morning and out the door, and then getting them home after they're exhausted and getting them, fed, bathed, and into bed. Our interactions with them are primarily on the weekends, which most weekends go pretty well, as long as we have, things planned. But we're also two white guys raising African-American daughters. So hair, is a thing. You could do another podcast.
That's your entire Saturday right there.
But I appreciate the question, and everyone often asks, but I think John and I have a pretty good sense of humor about our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We also work together, so we see each other all the time.
Yeah.
So, but certainly there have been a couple times where we're like, we really should try to do a date night. We should try to do this, that, and the other. But we also know that four kids.
Or take a nap.
We're going to go to a hotel now to take a nap for an hour.
Wow. So that's John and Brian's story. And, you know, some of the takeaways I get from that one is I really applaud and admire how they kept building those connections with their daughter's birth family, even when the formality of the system can make that really hard or uncomfortable.
The caseworker who said, you know, why would you want to know?
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, what wouldn't we want to know? We're being parents to these kids.
Yeah.
Again, I think that just shows, too, the state of foster care. The caseworkers are used to foster parents who maybe don't do this level.
Yeah, maybe, but it also goes back to what you were mentioning in one of our other episodes about the secrecy, and we certainly were kept in the dark about, I'd say, 85% of our kiddo's case. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, that's really appropriate because it's none of our business. But in other instances, it can be really tricky to have that level of secrecy between the two families because you're all trying to cultivate an environment that is about us all being on the same team and doing what's right for the kiddo.
Well, I think
very hard if you don't understand what the side of the story.
I think the system is not trying to cultivate that at all.
No, we are.
Yeah.
Just Kurt and Marika.
Well, you know, and other foster parents who are invested in the way that we are.
Yeah.
I think that's the point of a lot of this whole podcast is that we want to get the system to maybe shift its thoughts from keeping that secrecy and keeping the thing to notice that at the end of the line, it's just going to affect the kid in adverse ways. So let's
potentially, yeah. Yeah. That. And we're not saying that absolutely everything needs to be shared in terms of intimate details of people's family life, because that's not.
Yeah. But just get them together, have a cup of tea is kind of what we're saying.
Like, there's nothing that a cup of tea can't sort.
Damn straight.
The other thing that I think is worth talking about is John's mental health with having that moment. And if you have been a foster parent and you've been through what we've been through, there is a moment where you realize you could lose this person that you love like they're your insides. And that is the incredible duality and power and the thing we are asked to do as foster parents, but it doesn't make it any less difficult to deal with when you have to confront that head on.
We had that a couple of times. We had,
yeah, that's true.
You know, weeks where the agency would say to us, you know, you're going to potentially have to say goodbye to this kid this week.
Yeah.
And in one of those periods of time, I was in Australia and literally flew back.
Yeah.
Just, you know, because we were being told that
we were scared that she would get moved before he got back from Australia. Yeah.
And then that didn't happen. And you know, we'd flown back, but whatever, it's fine. But we had that again another couple of times in emergency circumstances. And, you know, I think with John and Brian's perspective there, there were a couple of things they talked about where they were given the support that we didn't get from our agency. And obviously being in New Jersey, maybe that's a thing in New Jersey, maybe it's a thing for that particular agency, but they were provided with counsellors.
Mm.
And there were a number of things that were mentioned there in that conversation where...
So we might have to move to New Jersey.
I don't want to do the path.
But no, I think overall, I want to, you know, call us, you know, Marika and Kurt, but call everyone who's in foster parenting to challenge themselves to support reunification, even when it feels uncomfortable or unnatural. And that's the ongoing challenge of being a foster parent. And we just wanted to finish off this week's episode talking about a TV series that we actually watched that we thought might be of interest to you. It's called The Day I Picked My Parents. And I originally went into watching this. It's kind of like a documentary TV series, which each episode focuses on a number of children who had TPR happen. And for anyone who's not aware, TPR is the termination of parental rights. So in almost all cases, these are kids that they're in their teenage years there, and they've been through foster system for quite a number of years, and then they've had TPR happen, and they are all seeking I know some people hate this term, but a forever family.
They're sitting around in foster care.
They're in foster care without a permanent home. Yeah. And so, you know, when I heard the name of the show, The Day I Picked My Parents, it just made me feel uncomfortable. And I thought, oh, are they going to make this a real salacious reality TV show? And it's going to, I don't know, I just was really apprehensive about watching it. But it's actually coming from a pretty interesting human place with a lot of beautiful insights into the psychology of these kids and how hard it can be when you've been sitting in the system for so long and you've undergone a lot of transition, a lot of different placements. And it's a really valuable exercise in learning from the perspective of foster youth. Incredibly interesting and insightful.
Mm-hmm. And where can you find it?
Well, I think we watched on Hulu. It doesn't seem to be available there, but it's produced by A&E TV. So if you have that subscription, you can watch it. Or you can buy the episodes, I think, for like $1.99 on Amazon or YouTube TV. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, guys. If you please, review and recommend us on the App Store or wherever you get your podcasts. I believe writing a 5-star review and saying some nice things just helps us get out there and be advertised amongst the internets and the foster community. Thanks for listening. We encourage you to make an inquiry about becoming a foster parent.
Because every kid deserves to be loved unconditionally, even when their future is uncertain.
We're the grown-ups. We can do that.
And every kid is worth it.